1961, when the Soviet cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin boldly went where no man had gone before, he did something that science fiction fans had been expecting for decades. Megan Prelinger is a historian and a science fiction fan, and she's written a book called Another Science Fiction Advertising the Space Race, which celebrates both our curiosity of the outer limits and how the idea was sold to the public. It's published by the appropriately named Blast Books, and I'm delighted to welcome Megan Prelinger to our show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You focus on our perception of space from the years 1957 to 1962. What had been our understanding of it prior to 1957?
Prior to 1957, it was a hoped-for enterprise, and one that many people were fascinated by and a compelling idea, but we did not yet have the technological evidence that we could make any aspirations tangible.
So people saw the inevitability of our reaching space? Or was it just simply something that people thought was in the realm of science fiction?
I think before 1957, it was more within the realm of science fiction, and not until the launch of Sputnik in October of 57 did it come to seem as anything other than just a hope.
But why is that? We had brought over rocket scientists from Germany who had revealed that you could probably aim for getting outside of Earth's atmosphere. It probably wouldn't be all that difficult. And there had been all these major advances in military research science. Industry was growing. Jet planes were now the norm.
What
was the problem?
And that's why we were able to adapt to the surprise launch of Sputnik with a nimbleness that let us, in the United States, our space programs caught right up, and we launched a satellite ourselves only 4 months after Sputnik. So it wasn't that we weren't getting ready. The technology was definitely headed in that direction, but it wasn't as well funded or as well widely publicly supported before Sputnik.
Well, let's take a listen to a Universal newsreel announcing the launch.
Today, a new moon is in the sky, a 23-inch metal sphere placed in orbit by a Russian rocket. Here, an artist's conception of how the feat was accomplished. A three-stage rocket. Number one, the booster in the class of an intercontinental missile. Its weight estimated at 50 tons. The smaller second stage took over at 5,000 miles an hour and carried on to the highest point reached. 500 miles up, the artificial moon is boosted to a speed counterbalancing the pull of gravity and released. You are hearing the actual signals transmitted by the Earth-circling satellite, one of the great scientific feats of the age.
Well, that sounds very positive, but weren't there many people in this country who were afraid that the Soviets could use space satellites as Cold War weapons?
Of course. There was a military subtext, supertext to the entire satellite programs. Both the Army and the Navy were working on competing satellite programs in 1955 and 56. Working on contributions to the International Geophysical Year. But the satellites also had civil application. All space systems have dual applications.
Mm-hmm. Were they thinking in the same ways that the Soviets had, a booster and then a second stage and,
yes,
and then the satellite?
Yes.
Was NASA created as a reaction to Sputnik?
Not directly.
Because it comes the next year.
Yes, it does come the next year. Well, there was such a rapid development in space technology at the time, and there was a broad support for the civil applicability of that new technology, and all the range of civil applications of the new technology needed a home, and NASA became that home.
And it was when it was established in 1958, it had an annual budget of $100 million. By 1960, it was $802 million. In 1962, it was $1.7 billion.
Right.
That is not just
right.
Inflation there.
No.
So I guess it was because we thought we might be able to achieve something, or was the public's interest in space increasing along with government spending?
Public interest and our developing sense of post-war technological excitement was definitely going to carry us into space. Since we had the space programs, we were able to develop first the Mercury and then the Gemini and then Kennedy on May 25th, 1961, announced the goal of the lunar landing by the end of the 1960s.
You discussed the role that advertising played in changing our perceptions of space. Why were advertisers involved at all?
Well, along with the budgetary developments that you point out, over 500,000 people were hired into industry in order to develop the systems needed to carry out the space programs that government planned. And those 500,000 people needed to be pulled out of the ranks of new engineers, scientists, and technicians. And the advertisements in the book are recruitment ads to convene that workforce for those projects.
Including an ad that talks about plasma thermionics and things like that. I would assume that was to separate the people who actually would be relevant to this kind of work from the rest of us who might just say, oh, my, that's not for me.
Well, and there was more going on than just recruitment. Yes, they wanted to speak to a technologically savvy audience and bring people in who had a frame of reference for participating in the new movements.
What is plasma thermionics? I still don't know.
Yeah, it's a form of propulsion. There are a set of propulsion systems that draw on electricity and magnetism, and they're not launch systems. They're ways that spacecraft can move around in orbit and in interplanetary space once they've already escaped the gravity well. But so the ads were also, the companies were jockeying for position with one another with respect to contracts being offered by NASA. So they were advertising both to recruit new workers in and to promote to their peers the kinds of projects they were engaged in.
You have included a lot of those ads in this book. This book, I should point out, has serious text, but also has lots of wonderful pictures and examples of things. And these ads also had lots of interesting images. What ad agencies were doing this? This wasn't BBDO, was it?
No, they were largely very small agencies, sometimes agencies as small as just one or two or three people, sometimes formed right on the spot in association with an industry location, such as Denver in Colorado, specifically to promote recruitment for a very specific set of projects.
The ad that mentioned plasma thermionics was called Another Aspect of the Marquardt Mission.
Mm-hmm.
Was there ever a Marquardt mission?
Yeah, Marquardt was a company from 1944 to the early 1970s, and they had contracts in both the development of conventional space systems and also alternative hybrid, what would have been and have never been built, but a hybrid atomic and chemical propulsion jets, and also strictly atomic jets.
Well, some of these images seem to be pretty accurate. So were they being the ad people being fed accurate stuff? For example, you point out that we had nonfiction images of space travelers before we even coined the term astronauts.
Mm-hmm.
But the images that we get look kind of recognizable.
Well, sure. There was a very fluid time of relations between emerging technologies and existing ways of visualizing technologies. And in some cases, the visualizations accurately anticipated things that were designed and built. In other cases, raw fantasy was applied to the cases of depicting things that were never built at all. So in hindsight, it looks like strict science fiction, but it often tells a story of a real technological project that may just not have come to fruition.
Were there any that were particularly outlandish?
Oh, there are many of them, yeah. The ones that promote the atomic bomb-driven rocket and where the copy explains that it'll take thousands of people into space and that where the parts of the ship are for the hydroponic gardens. Yeah, I mean, some of them draw on just the broadest palette of science fiction ideas.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Macon Praelinger, whose book, Another Science Fiction, Advertising the Space Race 1957 to 1962, is published by Blast. This is a large format book with lots of pictures in it. What I gather from the ads that you've reproduced is that space was sold as a contemporary manifest destiny. In fact, several seem to quote directly from the era of Western expansion with cowboys and horsemen. Was that the inspiration here?
Well, yeah, space was at the time conceived of as our next frontier. It was a useful kind of opportunity to take our Western landscape ideas of how we were going to geographically continue to grow as a country and, you know, turn them in a different direction. But those motifs didn't always translate so well out into space. You know, it turned out to be much, much harder to enter space than to enter Arizona or Nevada.
But I am assuming some of these ads were intended to affect, influence public opinion.
Well, the ads in this book were mostly seen by technical audiences.
Oh, so they weren't appearing in Life magazine?
Not many of them. That's one reason they haven't been exposed before now.
Well, listeners can view them on our webpage at WNYC.org. We've included several of the images. Do you think that Eisenhower-era Americans saw space as the next frontier in the same way that 19th-century Americans viewed California?
I think a large number of people did, yes. There was an enormous charisma to the our hopes and aspirations for exploration and expansion into space. Mm-hmm.
And they were also thinking of colonizing, setting up colonizing. I remember Ray Bradbury, of course, was writing about mm-hmm. that. But were people seriously thinking of that?
Well, some people were. Mm-hmm. Probably more than are today, yes.
There's a progression of the images in the book where earlier ads depict satellites. And as we flip through, we start seeing more humans. At what point did the graphic designers insert live humans into their images rather than just coming up with unmanned satellites?
In about 1959, we start seriously funding a human spaceflight mission that would become our Mercury mission. And right away, advocates of human spaceflight, then as now, were in a kind of politically contested environment where not everyone was behind the idea of human spaceflight or thought it was a good application of resources. And people really had to advertise that it's this human reach into space that we need to aspire toward in what was at the time some pretty tremendous opposition from the popular press and the scientific mainstream scientific press.
Things turned around when Yuri Gagarin went up for the first time. He didn't go very high either.
No, he did a low orbit. And that was right in the middle of our kind of national public debate over whether human spaceflight was a reasonable and worthy goal. But I see these images of the human body into space as a really deliberate initiative to anthropomorphize the human reach into space.
We're going through that debate again now, aren't we?
Yeah, we sure are.
Some people are saying robots are the best approach. Mm-hmm. Others are saying, mm-hmm. well, you really can't do certain things unless a human is involved.
Right. And you know, human spaceflight, it really is a cultural enterprise more than a scientific enterprise. It can also be scientific. They're bundled together. But with robotic spaceflight, you do get more research bang for your buck. And so, of course, there's enormous support, overwhelming support in the scientific community for robotic spaceflight. And yet, the human desire to reach and to touch is real and it's inalienable, but it has its roots in cultural sphere.
On the other hand, I know any time I've talked about this on this show, and I had a show recently with some people who'd been up as part of our space program, we always get listeners who say, well, we know more about the surface of the moon than we know about our own seafloors, and the government should be spending money on things like hunger, disease, and climate change and not worry about going to Mars.
Well, spending money on space programs is spending money on Earth sciences, because one of the leading purposes of space sciences is both to expand our geophysical awareness of our planet, and climate science is hugely reliant on space sciences, and also understanding our planetary history in the context of the other planets in the solar system will help us understand Earth ecology better.
The Atlantis just made its final voyage, and the remaining two space shuttles will be retired this year. Where is the space program headed?
Well, that's it's an open question right now. It's a very interesting time. We have all the technology at our disposal to reformulate what will probably end up being some kind of hybrid civil commercial space program.
Because the Obama administration wants to cut public spending of the space program and let private corporations take over at least part of the responsibility?
Yeah, I mean, they're going to cut funding of the human spaceflight program, not necessarily our robotic geophysical and planetary research. And there's going to be greater participation from the commercial sphere, what they call the new space sphere, that's based largely in the Mojave Desert in California, in our human spaceflight program. And I think it's a really exciting time for those programs.
Well, do you think it'll mean that we'll start seeing ads again of the sort, a modern version of the ads that you have in your book from the early days?
There are a few on billboards if you drive through the desert down in the Mojave recruiting people into new space industry. That being said, I don't think print advertising is going to play the same kind of role in society that it did 50 years ago. So I think we'll see just different kinds of manifestations of this new enthusiasm.
We'll probably be seeing internet ads. Before you go, can you tell us a bit about the Prelinger Library, which you co-founded?
Sure. My partner, Rick Prelinger, and I combined book collections and ideas about developing a library that would provide public access to historical materials that aren't commonly available, either in public libraries or in academic research libraries. We opened our collection to the public about 6 years ago in San Francisco.
But haven't you done away with the Dewey Decimal System?
We have.
How could you do that?
Well, the Dewey Decimal System doesn't serve every purpose, every collection, every need. We felt that it would be our collection would be better served by a geospatial taxonomy, one that starts where our feet meet the ground in San Francisco and ends in space. We have a wide range of subjects of 20th and 19th century American cultural history, industrial, technological, social, and landscape history.
To some degree, what you've done is you've put subjects together so
yes.
that we see more connections rather than
exactly.
just an alphabetical or...
Exactly. It's an associative system that offers browsers the opportunity to discover links that might not be juxtaposed elsewhere and, you know, to hopefully get some new ideas from those links.
The book that we've been talking about, Megan Prelinger's Another Science Fiction, Advertising the Space Race, 1957-1962, is published by Blast Books, and I thought it was amusing that one of the blurbs is from Gay Perello, who is the prop master for Mad Men. He said, "I wish I had this book when I started Mad Men. This is exactly what I look for." You gave him a real sense of what advertising looked like at that time.
Yeah, I'd appreciate the words from Gay.
And a reminder that you can see some images from the book on our show page at wnyc.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.